Okay, let's unpack this. If you own or manage tangible property, maybe it's a small office building, a retail space, a warehouse, or even, machinery used in your business, you face this fundamental question every time you spend money on it.
Right.
Is that cost for something routine, something that just keeps the lights on, keeps the property running smoothly? Or is it for something more substantial, an upgrade, maybe a restoration, something that actually makes the property better or lasts longer?
And that distinction, well, it dictates everything for your taxes. Whether you get that immediate tax deduction, boosting your cash flow right now,
Which is what most people want.
absolutely,
Yeah.
or whether you have to capitalize that cost and spread that tax benefit out over many, many years through depreciation.
And historically, that was a massive gray area, wasn't it?
Oh, completely. Before 2014, trying to figure out the difference between a deductible repair and a capital expenditure, it wasn't about clear rules. It was more like interpreting, decades of sometimes conflicting court cases and IRS rulings. Very subjective, confusing, and honestly, a constant source of tension. And audits. Lots of audits for businesses.
Exactly. It felt like trying to find your way through a maze without a map, which is, I guess, precisely why the Treasury Department and the IRS introduced the Tangible Property Regulations, or TPRs.
That's right.
Think of these regulations, which became mandatory back in 2014, as kind of the official IRS map and guidebook designed to bring clarity and structure to that whole subjective world of property costs.
Yeah, the TPRs basically took all that history, all that prior guidance, and consolidated it into a comprehensive framework. Their primary goal, their stated goal, is to provide clear rules to help taxpayers figure out, okay, is this expenditure a deductible repair or is it a capitalizable improvement?
And the key point you mentioned, mandatory.
Absolutely mandatory, not optional. If you incur costs on tangible property in your business, you must comply with the TPRs for tax years starting on or after January 1st, 2014, period.
Got it. Okay, mandatory rules. So, what are we diving into today? We've got a fantastic source here that really digs into the TPRs. It lays out the core concepts, why they exist, the benefits, the risks, which are pretty serious if you get it wrong, and it details the key provisions.
It's a great resource, yeah. It really helps understand the mechanics, but also the strategic side of these regulations. It clarifies that, okay, yes, they're complex, but compliance actually offers some significant opportunities.
Absolutely. So our mission in this deep dive is really to cut through that complexity. We want to pull out the most important insights, translate that, technical tax jargon into practical knowledge you can actually use. This is about understanding not just what the TPRs require, but also where the real opportunities for tax savings are, and critically, the potential traps, the pitfalls of non-compliance.
Right.
Our goal is basically to give you a shortcut to being well-informed on a really fundamental area of tax law that affects, well, almost every business owner.
And to do that well, we need to build it up from the basics. We'll start by understanding the old problem, the history the TPR solved. Then we'll explore those foundational definitions like unit of property and building systems. You really need those first.
Villain building.
Exactly. Then we'll get into the core decision repair versus improvement and really delve into the specific tests the TPRs provide, the RVB rules.
RBI rules, okay. And we'll also look at the simplifying tools, right? The ones designed to make life maybe a bit easier for certain costs, the safe harbors.
Yes, the safe harbors are key for reducing some of that burden. And crucially, we'll unpack some really powerful tax-saving opportunities these regulations unlock. Things like Section 481A adjustments, which let you kind of look back and correct past accounting methods
That do-over almost.
in a way, yeah. And partial asset dispositions, which can generate immediate tax losses when you do renovations. Very powerful.
Okay. And finally, we'll tie all this into how it impacts depreciation and importantly, clearly lay out the very real, very severe risks if you don't comply with these mandatory rules.
It's definitely a lot to cover, but honestly, getting this right is just fundamental to good tax planning if you own property.
Okay, let's start at the beginning then. Why did these TPRs even need to exist? What was the actual problem the IRS was trying to fix back then?
Well, as we touched on, the core problem was subjectivity and inconsistency. Before the TPRs became mandatory in 2014, the rules for telling a repair apart from a capital expenditure, they came from decades of case law, numerous IRS rulings, and sometimes they contradicted each other.
So no single clear roadmap.
Not at all. There wasn't one clear set of rules taxpayers could reliably point to.
So you could ask two different accountants about the same roof repair and potentially get two different answers on whether to expense or capitalize it.
Precisely. Depending on which lawyer or accountant you asked or which specific court case they leaned on, yeah, you could get different answers for the exact same expenditure.
That sounds messy.
It was very messy. That lack of clear, consolidated guidance meant different businesses treated identical costs differently, which led to inconsistent reporting, lots of disagreements with the IRS during audits, just a general feeling of uncertainty for property owners trying to follow the rules.
What were the old rules based on then, generally?
They were often based on these broad principles, like did the expenditure materially add to the property's value or did it prolong its useful life? But applying concepts like materially or prolong consistently, well, that was really difficult in practice.
Yeah, sounds like a recipe for confusion and arguments.
It absolutely was. And the Treasury and the IRS, they recognized that this ambiguity was just inefficient for taxpayers and for the government. So the TPRs were issued to fix that, to provide a clearer, more structured framework. The stated goal, right in the regulations, is to simplify things and provide certainty.
Certainty in determining repair versus capital expenditure.
Exactly.
And that mandate in 2014, that really shifted the landscape.
It absolutely did. For 2014, you could potentially rely on older case law, even if it maybe didn't align perfectly with where the IRS thinking was heading. But once the TPRs became mandatory for tax years starting January 4, 2014, that was it. All taxpayers subject to these rules must apply the new framework. Understanding the TPR definitions, the tests, it's just non-negotiable now for anyone with business property.
Okay, but mandatory rules, they often bring some benefits too, right? What's the upside for taxpayers from all this structure and clarity?
The clarity is the primary benefit. By providing more definitive rules, the TPRs significantly cut down on the ambiguity compared to the old system.
Fewer gray areas.
Exactly. Fewer gray areas means less uncertainty for taxpayers. It minimizes the potential for disputes and audits with the IRS that stem from misclassifying costs and promotes more consistent tax reporting across different businesses, different industries.
So it's about reducing those arguments and increasing predictability.
That's the idea. And that predictability, that's what empowers taxpayers. When you understand the rules clearly, you can proactively plan your spending. You can implement better tax strategies. You might identify opportunities for immediate deductions that maybe you would have missed under the old subjective system.
Ah, so it could actually lead to tax savings.
Potentially significant tax savings.
Right.
And definitely improved cash flow.
Yeah.
It shifts the dynamic, you know,
yeah.
From just reacting to potential IRS challenges to proactively optimizing your tax position based on a known set of rules.
That sounds like a much stronger position to be in. Okay, let's get into those core concepts then, the foundation of this TPR guidebook. You mentioned unit of property and building systems. Let's start with the unit of property, or UOP. Why is this the absolute starting point, and what exactly defines it?
The unit of property, or UOP, it's fundamental because every single decision about whether an expenditure is a repair or an improvement, it's made at the UOP level. So if you define your UOP incorrectly at the start, everything that follows your analysis, your classification of costs, it's probably going to be wrong. It's like trying to use a map where the scale is completely off. Everything you measure from that point on will be incorrect.
Got it. So it sets the scale, the boundary for the analysis. How does the source actually define a UOP?
Generally speaking, a UOP includes all the functionally interdependent components of a property.
Functionally interdependent, meaning what?
Meaning the operation of one component depends on the operation of another. If one piece stops working and the whole thing can't do its job, its intended function, then those pieces are likely part of the same UOP.
Okay, like on a machine, you mentioned the motor, the gears, the control panel. If one goes, the machine stops. They're interdependent.
Exactly. Those components that rely on each other to perform the overall function of the property, they get grouped into a single UOP. But there's another crucial distinction the source points out.
Oh.
Components are treated as separate UOPs if they're depreciated under different MCRS property classes.
MCRS being the depreciation system.
Right. So even if two components are physically attached, if they have different tax lives assigned by the depreciation rule, say one is 5-year property and the other is 7-year property, they might need to be treated as separate UOPs for applying the TPR rules.
Huh. That adds a layer. Let's dig into the real estate examples the source gives, because that seems like where this gets particularly critical.
It really does. For real estate, the UOP concept is applied differently depending on whether you're the owner or the tenant.
Okay.
If you're the owner of a building, the lesser, your UOP is generally the entire building structure.
The whole building.
Basically, yes. However, if you are a tenant leasing just a portion of that building, the lessee, your UOP is typically only the portion of the building you lease.
Wow, okay. So the size of your UOP can be drastically different. A tiny office lease versus owning the whole skyscraper. Why does that matter so much in practice?
It matters tremendously because the cost of any expenditure is evaluated relative to the UOP.
Relative to the size of that boundary we set.
Exactly. The source gives a great example. Think about a $15,000 bathroom renovation. If you're the lessee and that renovation is inside your small, say, 500 square foot leased space, that $15,000 could be a pretty significant chunk of your UOP's value or its functional capacity.
Right, relative to just that small space.
It's much more likely to be considered a capital improvement under those RDI rules we'll get to because it's substantial relative to your small UOP.
But if you're the owner of the whole building.
Now flip it. If you're the owner and that same $15,000 is spent on one bathroom in a huge, say, 50,000 square foot office building, well, that $15,000 expenditure is comparatively tiny relative to the entire building's value or its vast plumbing system.
But so for the owner, it's more likely
Not
just.
a deductible repair in that context, much more likely.
Wow. So the exact same physical work, the same $15,000 cost, could be a capital expenditure you have to depreciate over years for a tenant, but an immediate tax deduction for the building owner.
Absolutely. It just highlights perfectly how critical it is to correctly define your specific unit of property first. It completely changes the analysis.
Okay, so for commercial buildings, the owner's UOP is generally the whole structure. But you mentioned something about systems.
Right. For commercial buildings specifically, while the building structure itself is typically the main UOP, the regulations require that the capitalization rules, those RBI tests, are applied separately to the building structure itself and to a specific defined systems.
Which brings us neatly to that other key concept, building systems. What are these systems and why break them out separately from the main building UOP?
So the regulations list out specific systems within a building that have to be analyzed independently when you're deciding if a cost is a repair or an improvement. Even though the building might be the overall UOP, work done on, say, the HVAC system is evaluated as an expenditure on that specific system.
Okay, and why is that separation important?
It's key for applying the RBI rules and the safe harbors correctly. You analyze the cost relative to the system it affects, not necessarily the entire building structure for every single cost.
Got it. What are these systems? The source lists nine of them, I think.
That's right. Let's run through them. You've got one, the heating, ventilation, and air conditioning system, the HVAC.
Standard.
Two, the plumbing system. Three, the electrical system.
Hmm.
Four, the fire protection system, think sprinklers, alarms. Five, the security system. Six, elevators and escalators. Seven. Then, importantly, the structural components of the building itself are treated as a system. This includes the walls, floors, ceilings, the roof, doors, windows, the basic structure.
So the structure is a system within the structure, UOP. A bit circular, but okay.
Yeah, functions that way for the analysis.
Good.
Eight, site improvements. These are things outside the building footprint, but on the property, like roads, parking lots, fences, sidewalks, retaining walls, landscaping. And finally, nine, other specialized systems. This is kind of a catch-all for systems specific to the building's use, like maybe specialized manufacturing equipment integrated into the building or unique systems in a food processing plant.
That makes sense. So if you're looking at fixing the roof, you analyze that cost in the context of the building structure system. If you're working on the AC, you look at the HVAC system.
Precisely. And defining these systems within your UOP, whether that UOP is the whole building or just your leased portion, that's the second foundational step you need to take. Once you have your UOP and your building systems defined, then you're ready to tackle that core decision, repair versus improvement.
Okay, let's get to that core decision then. If a safe harbor doesn't apply, and we'll talk about those soon, how do the TPRs guide you using these RABI rules you mentioned?
Right, this is really where the rubber meets the road. The fundamental question remains, is the cost just an ordinary repair that keeps the property running efficiently? Is it deductible now, or is it an improvement? Does it enhance the property, restore it after significant decline, or adapt it to a new use? If it's an improvement, it generally has to be capitalized.
And if you can't use one of the safe harbors.
Then you turn to the RABI tests. These are the specific tests spelled out in the regulations that determine if an expenditure must be capitalized because it constitutes an improvement.
Okay, RABI stands for restoration, adaptation, betterment, and improvement. Let's break those down. What counts as a restoration?
A restoration involves returning the UOP, or one of its building systems, back to its normal, efficient operating condition after it has deteriorated significantly or is basically no longer functional. It's not just patching something minor up. It's more like a major overhaul. The source describes it as Returning the property to a like-new condition, or replacing a major component, or a significant portion of a major component of the UOP, or replacing a substantial structural part of the UOP.
So replacing, like, one broken window pane probably isn't a restoration, but maybe replacing all the windows on one whole side of the building.
That's the kind of distinction, yes. It's about the scope and the impact on the UOP, or the system's overall condition. It involves looking at quantitative factors, how much you're replacing, and qualitative factors, what state are you bringing it back from, and what state are you bringing it to. Replacing a minor piece isn't restoration. Replacing something significant usually is.
Got it. Bringing it back from a serious state of decline. Okay, how about adaptation?
Adaptation is probably the most straightforward of the bunch. It's when you change the UOP to a new or different use.
Like?
The classic example is converting a warehouse into loft apartments, or changing a retail store into a restaurant. You're adapting the property to function in a way it wasn't originally designed or used for.
Pretty clear. Okay, next is betterment. This sounds more nuanced.
It definitely is. Betterment is probably the most nuanced of the RBI tests. It involves expenditures that do one of three things. First, they might fix a material defect or condition that existed before you acquired the property.
Fixing something that was already broken when you bought it?
Right. Second, it could be costs that result in a material addition to the UOP, like adding a new wing or a significant new component. Or third, expenditures that result in a material increase in the capacity, productivity, strength, or quality of the UOP, or one of its systems, compared to its state before the expenditure.
Okay, material seems to be the key word there. How do you measure material enhancement or addition? Is there a dollar threshold?
That's the tricky part, and the regs say it's highly dependent on the specific facts and circumstances. The source does mention that the IRS has suggested in some guidance, not a hard rule, mind you, that expenditures around, say, 30% of the UOP's adjusted basis might be considered material. But it strongly emphasizes this is not a bright line test.
So no magic number.
Definitely not. And it depends heavily on the size of the UOP. Remember our bathroom example?
Yeah, the $15,000 renovation.
Right. That $15,000 is much more likely to be considered a material betterment if your UOP is just a small $50,000 leased office space compared to if your UOP is a $5 million building. The same dollar cost can easily be material on a small UOP, but pretty insignificant on a large one.
So it always comes back to being relative to the unit of property.
Okay.
And the source also lists improvement itself as part of ORB, sometimes with percentage thresholds mentioned in the FAQs. How does that fit? Is it a separate test?
Yeah, the source's presentation there can be a little confusing. Generally, restoration, adaptation, and betterment are the specific tests that, if met, result in the cost being classified as a capital expenditure. The term improvement is often used more broadly to just mean anything that falls under R, A, or B.
So R, A, and B are the improvements?
Essentially, yes. The FAQ section in the source does seem to list improvement as if it's a separate test, mentioning things like thresholds, like affecting more than, say, 33% of all like components within a system, for instance, replacing over a third of the plumbing pipes.
So maybe think of restoration, adaptation, and betterment as the main defined tests. If an expenditure meets one of those, it's generally considered a capital improvement, which is the opposite of a deductible repair.
Okay, so R, A, or B generally means you capitalize it as an improvement.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how do the TPRs change the game in applying these ideas, especially if you're doing a bigger project?
Ah, this is a really critical change the TPRs brought in. Under the old rules, the pre-2014 rules, even if you had an expenditure that looked at by itself might have seemed like a simple repair.
Yeah.
It had to be capitalized if it was done as part of a larger overall rehabilitation or improvement project. This was called the Plan of Rehabilitation Doctrine. So if I was gutting and remodeling an entire floor, and as part of that, I also did some minor wall patching or fixed a few leaky faucets. Under the old rules, those small repairs got swept up.
Exactly. They got swept into the larger capitalization project. You basically had to capitalize everything that was considered part of that broader plan.
Ouch.
But the TPRs changed this significantly. Now, repair costs can potentially be expensed even if they are incurred as part of the larger project, as long as they independently qualify as repairs under the general rule, or maybe under the materials and supplies rule, or if they fall under one of the safe harbors we'll get to.
Whoa, that's potentially huge. A game changer for anyone doing significant renovations. It means costs that might have been stuck in capitalization for decades under the old plan of rehab rule. Now they might be immediate tax deductions.
It absolutely is. This shift allows for potentially much greater immediate tax benefits during big renovation projects compared to the old rules, where way more stuff got forced into capitalization. It really highlights why you need to look at every expenditure within a renovation project independently against the current TPR rules.
And coming back to that materiality point for betterment, it really sounds like the size and scale of the unit of property we defined earlier are constantly playing a role in whether a cost is a deductible repair or a capital improvement under these RABI rules.
Absolutely critical. The analysis under the RB tests is always, always relative to the specific UOP or the specific building system involved. A cost that might be minor and clearly a repair on a large property could be significant enough to trigger a betterment finding on a smaller property. Defining that UOP correctly is the essential first step before you can even begin to apply the RB tests properly.
Okay, applying RABI still sounds like it might require a pretty detailed, maybe even expert analysis for every single expenditure. Are there parts of the TPRs designed to make compliance simpler for certain common costs?
Yes, thankfully there are. The TPRs include several specific safe harbors.
Okay.
These are elective provisions, well, mostly elective designed for administrative convenience. They basically allow certain types of expenditures, usually smaller or more routine ones, to be immediately expensed without needing that detailed facts and circumstances RABI analysis.
So they simplify things and give you a faster deduction.
Exactly. Using them simplifies compliance and can definitely provide faster tax deductions compared to capitalizing and depreciating.
Simplification sounds great. Let's
Yeah.
start with the first one mentioned, the de minimis safe harbor, or DMSH. What is it and who gets to use it?
Okay, the DMSH. It's an annual election that lets taxpayers immediately expense amounts paid for tangible property. This includes materials and supplies too if the cost falls below a certain dollar threshold. The key is it's applied per invoice or per item.
So it's basically a rule for expensing small stuff right away.
That's the idea. Deduct the small stuff immediately. Don't worry about capitalizing it.
What's the dollar threshold? Does it vary?
It does. It depends on whether you have what are called applicable financial statements or AFS.
Which usually means audited financials.
Generally, yes.
Well.
Audited financial statements prepared according to GAAP or IFRS or filed with the SEC or another government agency. For taxpayers without AFS, which is going to be most small and medium-sized businesses, the threshold is $2,500 per item or per invoice.
Okay, $2,500 for most businesses. And if you do have
If
AFS.
you have AFS, the threshold is higher, $5,000 per item or per invoice.
And how do you actually take advantage of this? Is it automatic?
No, this is crucial. It's an annual election. You have to affirmatively choose to use it each year. You do this by attaching a specific statement to your timely filed original tax return for the year, including any extensions.
Timely filed. So if you miss filing the election with your return.
You can't use the DMSH for any expenditures in that year. You lose it for that year. And once you make the election for a year, it's irrevocable for that year. You can't change your mind later.
Okay, timely election statement is key. You mentioned per invoice or per item. How does that work practically? Say, buying equipment.
Right. The threshold applies to the cost of each individual item. Or you can look at the total cost on an invoice, depending on how things are billed. Now, the cost of the property for the DMSH threshold includes any additional costs, like shipping, delivery, or installation, but only if those extra costs are included on the same invoice as the item itself.
Okay, example.
Sure. Let's say you buy a piece of equipment for $2,400, and the shipping is $200. If that $200 shipping charge is on the same invoice as the equipment, the total invoice cost is $2,600.
Which is over the limit for non-AFS taxpayers.
Exactly. If you don't have AFS, the $2,600 is over the $2,500 threshold, so you cannot use the DMSH to expense that equipment. You'd have to capitalize it and depreciate it, or see if another rule applies.
But what if that $200 shipping charge was billed separately on a different invoice?
Ah, then the equipment cost on its own invoice is $2,400. That's below the $2,500 threshold. So you could elect to use the DMSH to expense the $2,400 equipment cost immediately.
And the separate shipping invoice.
That $200 shipping cost would likely just be a deductible expense anyway, probably as a delivery charge or maybe a material or supply cost. It wouldn't prevent you from using DMSH on the main item.
That invoicing detail really matters then. Is there anything stopping people from just asking vendors to split invoices to get under the limit?
Well, the source does mention an anti-abuse rule here. You can't intentionally structure transactions, like splitting payments or asking for multiple invoices for what is really a single piece of property, just to manipulate your way under the DMSH threshold. That's not allowed.
Makes sense. It's meant for genuine small expenses, not gaming the system. Does DMSH apply to anything besides physical items like computers or small tools?
Yes. Importantly, it specifically applies to materials and supplies, including things like spare parts you keep on hand. If these items cost below the threshold amount per item or invoice, the DMSH allows you to deduct their cost upon purchase when you buy them, rather than having to wait until they are actually used or consumed, which is the general timing rule for deducting non-incidental materials and supplies.
Ah, so it can accelerate the deduction for supplies you stock up on?
Exactly. It gives you a timing advantage for that deduction.
Okay, that's helpful for those smaller, common expenses. What about the next one? The Safe Harbor for Small Taxpayers, the STSH? This sounds like it's more focused on buildings, specifically for smaller businesses.
It is. The STSH is definitely aimed at simplifying compliance for smaller property owners. To qualify, first, the taxpayer's average annual gross receipts for the prior three tax years must be $10 million or less.
Okay, a gross receipts test, $10 million average over 3 years.
Right. That's the taxpayer qualification.
And what kind of property and costs qualify if you meet that test?
It applies to costs for improvements, repairs, and maintenance. So broad range of costs incurred on a building that has an unadjusted basis of $1 million or less.
Unadjusted basis means the original cost plus improvements before depreciation.
Generally, yes. The original cost basis plus any subsequent capital improvements without reducing it for depreciation taken. So it's limited to buildings and only certain costs related to them, and only for businesses that meet that gross receipts test and buildings that meet the $1 million or less basis test.
Okay. If you qualify on both counts, what's the benefit? And is there a limit?
The benefit is, again, being able to expense costs that might otherwise have to be capitalized under the RRB rules. However, there's a very strict annual limitation on the total amount you can deduct under the STSH for any single qualifying building.
What's the limit?
The limit is the lesser of two amounts, $10,000 or 2% of the building's unadjusted basis.
$10,000 seems, well, not very much when you're talking about building work. Even 2% of $1 million is only $20,000. So the $10,000 cap seems likely to hit first often.
It often does. And here's the really critical part, the potential trap. This safe harbor is all or nothing for each building each year.
All or nothing.
Meaning, if your total expenditures on that specific building for the year, expenditures that would otherwise qualify for the STSH, if that total exceeds the limit, the lesser of $10 or 2% of basis, then none of those expenditures qualify for the STSH for that year. You lose the entire safe harbor benefit for that building for that year.
Ouch. That's a harsh cliff. So if your limit is $10,000 and you spend $10,500 on qualifying repairs and improvements, you can't expense the first $10,000.
Correct. You expense zero into the STSH. You'd have to go back and analyze all those costs under the regular RDI rules to determine if they're repairs or improvements.
Wow. Okay. Need to watch that limit carefully. Is this also an annual election like the DMSH?
Yes. Just like the DMSH, the STSH requires an annual election made on your timely filed tax return. And another point the source makes, expenditures on land improvements, remember, things like parking lots, fences, landscaping, those are not eligible for the STSH, even if they're part of the same property as the qualifying building. It only applies to the building itself.
The source mentions an interesting connection here between the STSH and cost segregation studies. It suggests a study could potentially help a taxpayer meet that $1 million building basis test. How would that work?
Yeah, that's a clever strategic point. Remember, a cost segregation study analyzes a building purchase or construction cost and reclassifies certain components from the long 27.5 or 39-year depreciation lives of real property into shorter lives, typically 5, 7, or 15 years, for things considered personal property or land improvements.
Right, things like carpeting, special electrical, some plumbing, maybe decorative fixtures.
Exactly. These items are physically part of the building, but for tax depreciation, a cost seg study treats them separately. So imagine you bought a building for $1.2 million. Initially, the unadjusted basis allocated just to the building structure UOP might be that full $1.2 million.
Which is over the $1 million threshold for STSH.
Right. But what if you do a cost segregation study and it identifies, say, $300,000 worth of components that can be reclassified into 5-year and 7-year property categories? Then the remaining basis allocated specifically to the building structure itself. The 39-year or 27.5-year part could drop to $900,000. 1.2 meter, $300.
Which is now under the $1 million threshold.
Exactly. So by performing the cost segregation study, you might suddenly make that building eligible for the small taxpayer safe harbor. potentially allowing you to expense up to $10,000 of repairs and improvements annually that you couldn't before.
That's fascinating. Using a tool primarily known for accelerating depreciation on capitalized items to actually enable more expensing under a safe harbor. It really shows how these different tax strategies can interplay.
It really does. You have to look at the whole picture.
Okay, let's move to the third safe harbor mentioned. Routine maintenance. This one sounds like it might apply more automatically, less paperwork.
Yes, the routine maintenance safe harbor, or RMSH, is different from the other two in a key way.
Mm-hmm.
It does not require an annual election.
Ah, no election needed.
Right. If your expenditures meet the specific criteria for routine maintenance, the safe harbor just applies automatically. You get the immediate deduction without having to attach a special statement to your return.
Okay, so what are the criteria for the RMSH? What makes maintenance routine?
It applies to costs for recurring activities that you can reasonably expect to perform more than once during a 10-year period. And the purpose of these activities has to be specifically to keep an asset like a building system or a piece of equipment or the building structure itself in its normal, ordinary operating condition.
So it's about predictable, regular upkeep to keep things running as they should.
Exactly. The key purpose here is preserving the existing functionality of the asset. It does not apply to expenditures that result in a better machine. Remember, improving the asset, enlarging it, making it materially more productive or efficient, that's not routine maintenance.
How do they judge the more than once in 10 years expectation?
It's based on your experience with similar property or industry standards. You look at the class life of the property, too. The test is whether the maintenance activity is reasonably expected to be necessary more than once during the 10 years after the asset is placed in service. Or, if the asset has a MECRS class life shorter than 10 years, then more than once during its class life.
Can you give some solid examples of what typically qualifies under RMSH?
Sure. The source gives common ones like periodically inspecting and performing scheduled maintenance on a building's HVAC system. Or maybe repainting the interior or exterior walls of a building every few years.
Okay. Painting makes sense.
Patching a small area of a roof. But importantly, not replacing a substantial portion or the entire roof membrane. That would likely be a restoration or betterment, not routine maintenance. Minor plumbing repairs, like fixing a leaky faucet, or minor electrical repairs, like replacing worn outlets, as long as you're not replacing a significant part of the whole system. Cleaning, janitorial services, these are the kinds of ongoing tasks that are just part of the normal operating cycle of keeping the property maintained.
So replacing a single broken HVAC component might fit, but installing a whole new, more efficient HVAC system definitely would not.
Exactly. That's the line. RMSH is about maintaining what you have, not upgrading or replacing major parts.
Got it. So for that ongoing predictable upkeep, the RMSH provides immediate expensing without even needing an election. That seems like a significant simplification and tax advantage compared to capitalizing those costs over many years.
It really is. It provides those immediate tax savings and definitely simplifies compliance for those common recurring costs. It's a great benefit for just maintaining your property effectively day to day.
Okay, fantastic. So we've covered why the TPRs exist, the foundational concepts UOP and building systems, the core RABIA test for telling repairs from improvements, and these simplifying safe harbors. Now let's shift gears a bit and talk about some of the really powerful tax-saving opportunities these regulations present, especially when looking back at past decisions or when undertaking major renovations. You mentioned Section 481A, adjustments, and partial asset dispositions.
Yes, these can indeed be real game changers for property owners. They offer ways to potentially capture deductions you might have missed in the past or create immediate tax losses during current projects. Let's start with the Section 481A adjustments.
Okay. What's the power behind a 481A adjustment specifically in the context of these tangible property regs?
The real power here is the ability to look back. To look back at expenditures you made in prior years, years after the TPRs became mandatory in 2014, that you might have capitalized under the old, more subjective way of thinking, or maybe just out of caution.
Yeah.
But which, under the clearer framework of the TPRs, would now actually qualify as deductible repairs. The Section 481A adjustment allows you to formally change your accounting method for how you treat those types of costs going forward, and critically, it lets you take a one-time catch-up adjustment in the current tax year.
A catch-up adjustment?
Yes, usually a deduction, representing the cumulative effect of having expensed those items in the prior years instead of capitalizing them.
So let me see if I get this. If, say, 5 years ago, I paid for a significant HVAC repair and I capitalized it then. But now, looking at the TPRs and the RAB rules, I realize Hey, that should have been a repair expense. I might be able to effectively expense that cost today using this 481A.
That's exactly the idea. You're essentially correcting an improper accounting method you used in a prior year. The mechanism for doing this is typically filing IRS Form 3115, which is the application for change in accounting method.
Form 3115. Okay.
Filing this form allows you to formally switch from your old, potentially incorrect method of accounting for certain repairs to the proper method required or permitted by the TPRs. The Section 481A adjustment is the calculation that quantifies the net effect of that change on your lifetime taxable income up to that point. And usually, if you're capitalizing things that should have been expensed, it results in a favorable deductible adjustment in the year you file the 3115.
Who is eligible to make this kind of adjustment? Can anyone just decide to capitalize wrong and take a deduction?
Well, eligibility often depends on how consistently you've been applying the TPR rules, particularly the RABBY rules for capitalization versus repair, since they became mandatory around 2014-2015. If you haven't been consistently applying the correct rules, you might still be able to make the change, but it might be considered an impermissible to permissible method change. This usually requires explicit consent from the IRS, and sometimes the adjustment might have to be spread over multiple years instead of taken all at once.
So consistency matters. What if you've been using the safe harbors correctly?
The source notes that consistently using the safe harbor methods correctly since 2015 does not disqualify you from making a 481A adjustment for other costs where you didn't use a safe harbor and may have incorrectly capitalized them under the RB rules. So using DMSH or STSH doesn't prevent you from fixing potential errors in applying the main repair versus improvement rules.
Okay. Filing Form 3115 sounds potentially complicated.
It definitely can be. Form 3115 is notorious for its complexity. It requires a lot of detailed information, the specific accounting method you're changing from and to, the legal basis for the change, like citing the specific TPR sections, a detailed calculation of the 481A adjustment itself, and you need to use specific codes the IRS assigns designated change numbers, or DCNs for different types of accounting method changes.
DCNs.
Yeah, the IRS has specific DCNs for changes related to materials and supplies under the TPRs, changes related to repairs, changes in capitalization methods, changes in defining UOPs, changes related to dispositions. It definitely requires careful attention to detail, or often professional help from someone experienced with these forms.
But the potential tax savings could make navigating that complexity really worthwhile.
Absolutely. Identifying and getting a current deduction for costs that were incorrectly capitalized in prior years can result in significant immediate tax savings in the year you make the accounting method change. This can substantially reduce your current year taxable income and provide a really valuable cash flow boost. The source points out that the mandatory nature of the TPRs actually provides a clear justification for making these changes now and realizing those past benefits you might have missed.
Okay, so that's about looking back and correcting. What about when you're doing work right now, like a major renovation project? That brings us to the second opportunity, partial asset dispositions or PADs.
Right. Partial asset dispositions are another incredibly valuable tax planning tool, particularly, as you say, for owners of commercial property who are undergoing renovations or making significant improvements.
What's the basic concept behind a PAD?
The concept is this: when you perform a renovation, and as part of that work, you remove and physically dispose of an old structural component or an old building system component, say. You tear off and replace an old section of roofing, or you pull out an old HVAC unit and install a new one, or you gut interior walls and flooring.
Yeah.
A partial asset disposition allows you to recognize an immediate tax loss in the current year. And that loss is equal to the remaining undepreciated basis of the old component that you just removed and threw away.
So the value that was still left on your books for depreciation purposes for that old roof section or old AC unit you just ripped out,
Yeah.
you get to deduct that remaining value right away as a loss.
Precisely. Plus, you can generally also deduct the costs associated with removing and disposing of that old component.
Wow. So that provides an immediate tax deduction, right?
Yeah.
Reduces your current year taxable income, improves cash flow right when you're spending money on the renovation.
Exactly. That's the immediate upfront benefit. But the advantages of doing a PD actually go beyond just that immediate deduction.
Ooh.
Well, it also cleans up your depreciation schedule. By formally disposing of the old asset component, you remove its basis from your books. This ensures that your future depreciation deductions are only calculated on the new replacement property you just installed.
Makes sense. Better record keeping.
Better record keeping, yes. And it also helps you avoid potential depreciation recapture later on when you eventually sell the property.
Depreciation recapture. Can you remind us briefly what that is and why avoiding it is good?
Sure. When you sell a business property for a gain, part of that gain might be attributable to the depreciation deductions you've claimed over the years. Under tax rules like Section 1245 or Section 1250, that portion of the gain, the recaptured depreciation, might be taxed at higher ordinary income tax rates or specific unrecaptured Section 1250 gain rates, which can be up to 25% instead of the potentially lower long-term capital gains rates, which currently max out at 20%.
So higher tax on the part of the gain that came from depreciation.
Right. By disposing of the old component's remaining basis now via a PAYD loss, you effectively reduce the total accumulated depreciation associated with the property over its life. This, in turn, reduces the amount that could be subject to that higher rate recapture tax when you eventually sell the entire property. The source highlights this, pointing out that taking the loss on the retired assets basis now can help ensure more of your future capital gain qualifies for the lower 20% maximum rate, potentially resulting in significant permanent tax savings by avoiding those higher recapture rates.
Okay, that sounds like a clear double benefit then. Immediate deduction now and potentially less tax at a higher rate later on. Seems like a no-brainer during a renovation. Is there a catch with PTAs?
There is a very, very big catch, and it's absolutely critical to understand. This opportunity is use it or lose it, and it is extremely time-sensitive.
Use it or lose it.
Yes. You must identify the disposed component, determine its basis, document the disposition, and claim the resulting loss on your tax return for the specific tax year in which the renovation is completed and the old component is actually disposed of.
The year it happens.
The year it happens. If you miss that year, if you don't claim the PAD loss on the return for the year the old asset hits the dumpster, you permanently lose the ability to claim that tax loss for that specific disposed component. There's no going back later with a Form 3115 like you can for correcting past repair versus capitalization methods. The PAD loss is lost forever if you don't claim it timely.
Wow, that is a huge implication. So if you do a big roof replacement this year, you have to figure out the basis of the old roof and claim the PAD loss on this year's tax return. You can't wait until next year.
Correct. Proactive planning during the renovation process is absolutely essential to make sure you don't leave that potentially significant tax deduction on the table.
How do you actually claim a PAD loss on your return? Is it complicated?
For tax years, starting in 2014 and later, the mechanics are relatively simpler than they used to be for some older dispositions. You basically just report the gain or loss from the partial disposition on your timely filed original tax return for that year. You typically report it on Form 4797, Sales of Business Property. You don't need to file a separate specific election statement or file a Form 3115 just to claim the PAD loss itself anymore, unlike some complex rules that applied for cashing up on missed PDs from years before 2014.
So report it like other asset sales or dispositions. What's usually the biggest challenge in actually claiming a PE then?
The biggest practical challenge, by far, is determining the basis of the specific component you disposed of.
Right. Because if you bought a building 10 years ago, the purchase contract probably just said $1 million for the building. It didn't say $50,000 for the roof and $30,000 for the HVAC unit.
Exactly. The original purchase price allocation usually isn't that detailed. The regulations just say you need to use a reasonable method to determine the basis of the disposed portion. But what's reasonable?
Yeah. How do you figure that out reasonably?
This is where, once again, a cost segregation study becomes incredibly valuable, almost essential sometimes.
Ah, cost seg again.
Yes. The IRS specifically accepts the use of cost segregation studies for determining the basis of disposed components in a PP. A qualified engineering firm performing the study can analyze the building, identify the component being removed, and estimate its original historical cost basis. They can even use techniques like applying the Producer Price Index, the PPI, to trend current replacement costs back in time to estimate what that component likely cost when the building where that component was originally placed in service years ago.
So they can reconstruct a reasonable original cost for that old roof or HVAC unit.
They can develop a well-documented and defensible basis calculation. Without a study, you might have to try and rely on things like contractor estimates from the time of original construction, or maybe insurance appraisals, or some kind of pro rata allocation based on square footage. Methods which can be less precise and potentially harder to defend if challenged by the IRS.
So a cost segregation study isn't just key for accelerating depreciation on the new stuff you put in. It also provides the necessary data to claim the loss on the old stuff you take out via PADs.
Absolutely. They work perfectly hand in hand. A good cost-seg study done during or right after a renovation will not only allocate the costs of the new improvements to their optimal depreciation lives, but it'll also calculate the basis of the old components that were removed, allowing you to claim those PAD losses.
Okay. The source also makes another important tactical point related to PADs. It mentions that many taxpayers actively avoid or maybe even revoke something called General Asset Account, or GAA, elections for their property. Why would they do that? What's a GAA?
Okay, a General Asset Account election is basically a simplifying convention where you group multiple assets with the same depreciation characteristics into a single account, and you depreciate the whole accounts as one item. It simplifies record keeping in some ways. But there's a big downside if you plan to do renovations. If an asset is included in a GAA, the general rule is that you do not recognize any gain or loss on the disposition of a single asset within that GAA. You just keep depreciating the entire account until the last asset in it is disposed of.
So if my building structure is in a GAA and I replace the roof?
Since a partial asset disposition is treated as the disposition of part of an asset, the building UOP or a building system UOP, PAD losses are generally disallowed for property that's included in a GAA election. So, if you want to preserve your ability to claim those valuable PAD losses during future renovations, you generally should not elect GAA treatment for your building or its major systems. Many taxpayers who might have made GAA elections in the past now actively revoke them for this reason.
That's a really specific but potentially very impactful planning point. Don't use GAAs if you want PAs.
Okay. We've talked a lot about expensing costs right away through safe harbors, or by identifying them as repairs using IB. But if a cost must be capitalized because it's an improvement under RBI, how does that tie into the depreciation system? And are there ways to accelerate those capitalized deductions too?
Right. So if a cost is determined to be a capital improvement under the TPR rules, its recovery, meaning getting the tax deduction for it, begins through the process of depreciation. And for most business property placed in service after 1986, depreciation is calculated using the Modified Accelerated Cost Recovery System, or MACR.
MACS.
Okay.
MACRs actually includes two primary systems within it. The General Depreciation System, GDS, and the Alternative Depreciation System, ADS.
GDS and ADS. What's the difference and when would you use each one?
GDS is the default system, and it's usually the more beneficial one for taxpayers. It typically uses accelerated depreciation methods like double declining balance and assigns shorter recovery periods to assets. This means you get larger depreciation deductions earlier in the property's life, which is generally better for cash flow.
So GDS is usually preferred. When would you use ADS?
ADS, on the other hand, uses only the straight line depreciation method, and it applies over generally longer recovery periods. You are required to use ADS for certain specific types of property.
Like what?
The list includes things like listed property think vehicles, computers used for personal purposes too, if the business use is 50% or less. Also, property that's used predominantly outside the United States, property financed with tax-exempt bonds, and, relevant for buildings, property leased to tax-exempt entities like governments or charities.
Can you give an example of when ADS might be mandatory for a whole building?
Sure. The source mentions a couple of scenarios involving leases. If you lease more than 35% of a building's net rentable square footage to a tax-exempt entity under what's called a disqualified lease, the entire building might have to be depreciated using ADS, often over 40 years instead of 27.5 or 39. Also, if a lease term for real property is longer than 20 years, including renewal options, unless the rent resets to fair market value at renewal, ADS might be mandatory for that property.
Okay. And can you choose to use ADS even if it's not required?
Yes. Taxpayers can elect to use ADS even if they aren't required to. Sometimes they might do this for simplicity or if they're in a low tax bracket currently and expect higher income later, but usually it results in slower depreciation deductions.
Got it. And GDS, the default system, that's where we see those different asset classes with different tax lives we hear about.
Exactly. Under GDS, MCRS assigns different types of property to specific asset classes, and each class has a designated recovery period, the number of years over which you depreciate it. The source lists some common examples. 5-year property. This is a common one. It includes things like computers, printers, copiers, calculators, but also automobiles and light or heavy-duty trucks used in business.
Okay, 5 years for tech and vehicles.
7-year property.
Yeah.
This is another big category. Catches a lot of common business assets like office furniture and fixtures, desks, chairs, filing cabinets, safes. Also communication equipment. And importantly, most other tangible personal property that doesn't fit into another specific class usually defaults to being 7-year property.
So 7 years for furniture and fixtures and kind of a catch-all.
15-year property. This is where many, but not all, land improvements fall under GDS. Things like roads, parking areas, fences, sidewalks, retaining walls, and landscaping on your business property.
15 years for paving and landscaping.
Right. And then, of course, you have the longer lives for buildings themselves. 27.5 years for residential rental property and 39 years for non-residential real property, like office buildings, warehouses, retail stores, under GDS.
Okay, so once a cost is capitalized under the TPRs as an improvement, you figure out it's MACRS class 5, 7, 15, 27.5, or 39 years usually, and you start depreciating it using GDS unless ADS is mandatory. Now, are there ways to speed up even those capitalized deductions, get the benefit faster than standard depreciation?
Yes, absolutely. Even for costs that must be capitalized under the TPRs, Congress has provided some very powerful tools designed to accelerate the depreciation deductions. The two main ones are Section 179 expensing and bonus depreciation.
Okay, let's talk about Section 179 first.
Section 179 expensing allows eligible businesses to elect to treat the cost of certain qualifying property as an expense rather than a capital expenditure. This means you can deduct the full cost of the property in the year you place it in service up to a certain annual dollar limit.
Full cost deduction immediately. That sounds huge.
It is a huge benefit. It basically turns what would have been a multi-year depreciation process into an immediate upfront deduction. Now, there are limits. The source gives the numbers for 2015 as context. Back then, the maximum amount you could expense under Section 179 was $500,000 per year.
Okay.
But there was also an investment limit. That $500,000 maximum deduction started to phase out dollar for dollar if you placed more than $2 million worth of eligible property in service during the year. So if you placed, say, $2.2 million property in service in 2015, your Section 179 limit was reduced to $300,000. And if you hit $2.5 million or more in qualifying purchases in 2015, you couldn't claim any Section 179 deduction that year. These limits change over time, by the way.
Got it. Phase-outs apply. What if you don't have enough business income to use the full deduction?
Good point. The Section 179 deduction is also limited to your business's taxable income for the year. You can't use it to create or increase a net operating loss. However, any amount you can't deduct because of the income limitation can generally be carried forward to future tax years.
Okay, carryovers are possible. Now, what kind of property qualifies for Section 179? Is it mostly for equipment, not buildings?
Generally, yes. Qualifying property for Section 179 is primarily tangible personal property. Things like machinery, equipment, computers, software off the shelf, vehicles, furniture, fixtures, purchased for use in the active conduct of a trade or business.
So not typically the building structure itself.
Not the building structure or its structural components, usually. However, the source notes that temporarily for a period ending in 2015, the law was expanded to allow Section 179 expensing for certain types of qualified real property. This included things like qualified leasehold improvement property, qualified restaurant property, and qualified retail improvement property, provided specific conditions were met. But that was a temporary provision.
Okay, so primarily personal property. Are there restrictions?
Yes, there are restrictions on certain types of property. For example, listed property, which includes assets like passenger automobiles, certain trucks, computers, and property used for entertainment or recreation, faces stricter rules. If your business use of listed property is 50% or less in a year, you generally cannot claim the Section 179 deduction for that property. You have to use regular depreciation, often under the slower ADS system.
Got it. Okay, so that's Section 179 for immediate expensing up to a limit. What about bonus depreciation? How is that different?
Bonus depreciation is another powerful tool for accelerating depreciation deductions on capitalized costs. Instead of expensing the full amount, like Section 179, bonus depreciation allows you to deduct an additional percentage of the cost of qualifying property in the very first year it's placed in service.
An additional percentage upfront.
Right. The source references the 2015 context, where bonus depreciation was set at 50% for qualified new property.
Mm-hmm.
So you get to deduct half the cost immediately and then appreciate the remaining half using the regular MCRS rules. Like Section 179, the bonus percentage has varied significantly over the years. It's even been 100% at times. Recently, though, it's phasing down now.
Is bonus depreciation elective?
Generally, bonus depreciation is mandatory unless you actively elect out of it. You have to make an election on your tax return if you don't want to claim bonus depreciation for a specific class of assets or for all qualifying assets placed in service that year. Otherwise, you're supposed to take it.
Okay, mandatory unless you opt out. What kind of property qualifies for bonus depreciation? Is it similar to Section 179?
It's similar but broader in some ways. Qualified property for bonus depreciation is generally new tangible property, though used property can qualify under certain recent rules, with a MACRS GDS recovery period of 20 years or less.
20 years or less, so that covers.
That covers most of your typical business assets. The 5-year property, computers, vehicles. The 7-year property, furniture, fixtures, equipment. And importantly, the 15-year property, land improvements like parking lots, fences. It also includes qualified leasehold improvement property. So bonus can apply to more types of property than Section 179 usually does, particularly land improvements.
How do bonus and Section 179 interact? If you buy equipment, can you use both?
Yes, and there's an order. You apply Section 179 first to the assets you choose, up to the limit. Then you apply bonus depreciation to the remaining basis of those assets, if they qualify for bonus, and to the full basis of other qualifying assets you didn't use Section 179 on. After taking both Section 179 and bonus depreciation, you then calculate your regular MACRS depreciation on any remaining basis over the asset's recovery period.
Okay, so 179 first, then bonus, then regular MCRSs.
Wow. So between the TPRs potentially allowing some costs to be fully expensed as repairs or via safe harbors, and then Section 179 and bonus depreciation allowing accelerated deductions, maybe even 100% upfront on costs that must be capitalized,
There
are really multiple pathways now to get significant tax benefits upfront for property expenditures.
Exactly. The landscape has become much more focused on allowing faster cost recovery compared to the old days of slow depreciation for almost everything. And bringing it all together, tying back to our earlier discussion, this is where a cost segregation study becomes such a powerful strategic tool that really intersects with both TPR compliance and these depreciation acceleration strategies.
We saw how cost segregation could potentially help you meet the basis test for the small tax payer safe harbor, and how it's crucial for value and components for partial asset dispositions. What's its overall role in this whole TPR and depreciation world? Well, the primary traditional role of a cost segregation study, usually performed by specialized engineers, is to maximize your depreciation deductions on capitalized costs. They do a detailed analysis of a building you've constructed or acquired, and they identify and reclassify components that are eligible for shorter depreciation lives, those 5, 7, or 15-year lives, separating them from the longer 27.5 or 39-year lives assigned to the base building structure.
So it accelerates your depreciation deductions on costs that had to be capitalized under the TPRs. More cash flow earlier.
Yes, that's its main function and benefit, accelerating depreciation, improving after-tax cash flow significantly in the early years of owning or improving a property. But as we've discussed, the source really highlights how cost segregation studies have become crucial for TPR compliance itself now.
How so? Again?
They provide the necessary detailed data to properly establish your unit of property baselines, especially by breaking down the building's components and systems with associated costs. And maybe most critically, they provide the IRS-accepted methodology for determining the historical cost basis of those components you dispose of when you do renovations, which is absolutely necessary for claiming those valuable partial asset disposition losses.
So they don't just speed up depreciation on the new stuff. They provide the foundational documentation you need to apply the TPR rules correctly for things like repairs versus improvements and to actually take advantage of opportunities like PAs.
Precisely. They're intertwined now. In fact, the source makes a really good point. It often makes sense to consider doing a TPR analysis, which includes looking back at past expenditures for potential 481A adjustments before you do a cost segregation study, or at least in conjunction with it.
Why that order?
Because you want to make sure you identify and claim any costs that are eligible for immediate expensing first, either as repairs under RABI or through the safe harbors. Expensing is almost always better than even accelerated depreciation. So you want to pull out everything eligible for immediate deduction before you start allocating the remaining capitalized costs to different depreciation buckets via the cost segregation study. Maximize expensing first, then accelerate the depreciation on what's left.
That makes perfect sense. Maximize the immediate write-offs, then optimize the timing of the rest. The source suggests a cost segregation study is often advisable when total expenditures for a building project, including leasehold improvements, exceed maybe $750,000. Is that a good rule of thumb?
That's a common threshold you hear. Below that, the cost of a formal engineering study might sometimes outweigh the tax benefits, although it depends on the specifics. But certainly, for projects involving expenditures of $750,000 or more on a structure, the potential benefits from accelerated depreciation, combined with the crucial data needed for TPR compliance and claiming PAIDs, usually make a cost segregation study a very strategic and worthwhile investment.
Okay. We've covered a lot of ground, the rules, the concepts, the opportunities, the strategies, but we also need to talk about the flip side. What's the downside? What actually happens if you don't comply with these mandatory tangible property regulations?
Yeah, the downside is significant. It's not something to brush off. As we've stressed, the TPRs have been mandatory for tax years, starting back in 2014. Failure to comply isn't just a minor bookkeeping error in the eyes of the IRS.
What are the direct consequences if the IRS catches non-compliance?
Well, the most direct consequence is the potential disallowance of your tax deductions. This means the IRS can come in and deny past, present, and potentially even future depreciation or expensing claims related to costs that you misclassified under the TPRs.
So if I incorrectly expensed something big that should have been capitalized as an improvement,
the IRS can disallow that entire deduction you took in the past year. They'll require you to capitalize it properly and start depreciating it over its correct, likely long recovery period. This can result in a significant, unexpected tax liability for the year you took the incorrect deduction, plus interest, plus penalties.
Ouch. And conversely, if I wrongly capitalize something small that really should have been expenses or repair,
then you've basically missed out on an immediate tax deduction you were entitled to. You'll only recover that cost slowly, year by year, through small depreciation deductions, instead of getting the full benefit up front. You've paid more tax than necessary in the earlier year.
So it can hit you with surprise back taxes, or just mean you've left money on the table by being too conservative.
Exactly. And those back taxes, especially when you add on accumulated interest and penalties, can become substantial figures. The IRS can assess accuracy-related penalties, potentially failure to file penalties if making the proper accounting method change required filing a Form 3115, but you didn't, and failure to pay penalties on the resulting tax due.
Does messing this up increase your chances of getting audited in the first place?
Oh, absolutely. The whole area of repairs versus capitalization has always been a focus for IRS audits, even before the TPRs. Now, with mandatory regulations in place since 2014, clear non-compliance with the TPR framework is a significant red flag. It definitely increases your likelihood of an IRS audit.
And audits are not fun.
Not fun at all. An audit stemming from TPR issues can be incredibly time-consuming. It distracts you and your management team from actually running your business. And it can be very costly in terms of professional fees. You'll likely need your accountant, maybe a specialized consultant, potentially even a tax attorney involved.
And once an audit starts looking at your TPR compliance, can it just expand into other areas?
Yes, that's a very real risk. An audit that begins by examining how you handled property costs can easily broaden its scope if the agency sees other potential issues on your return. It could uncover additional areas of non-compliance, leading to even more adjustments, more penalties, and more liabilities.
It really sounds like non-compliance isn't just about maybe losing a deduction here or there. It's about significantly increasing your overall risk profile and facing potentially complex, disruptive, and very costly consequences down the road.
It absolutely is. It's not a risk worth taking lightly. And trying to correct non-compliance after the fact is often difficult and expensive itself. As we mentioned with the Section 481A adjustments, if you've been consistently using an improper accounting method for years, you typically must file that complex IRS Form 31145 application for change in accounting method just to switch to the correct method going forward. That form, as we said, requires detailed information, specific DCN codes. It's much, much easier and less risky to get it right from the start or as soon as possible.
Okay. Given the complexity we've discussed, defining UOPs correctly, applying those nuanced RBI tests, navigating the different safe harbors and their election rules, understanding how to leverage opportunities like PAIDs and 481A adjustments, does this all strongly suggest that expert help is often needed to get this right?
The source definitely makes it clear that, yes, expert knowledge is often crucial, not just for ensuring proper compliance and avoiding those risks we just discussed, but also, just as importantly, for maximizing the potential tax benefits the TPRs offer. While the regulations provide a framework, applying that framework correctly to the unique facts and circumstances of your specific property, your specific expenditures, it can be really intricate.
So just relying on standard tax software or maybe a general tax preparer who doesn't specialize in this specific complex area, that might not be enough, especially if you have significant property or do renovations.
It really depends on the scale and complexity of your property holdings and expenditures. But yes, for businesses with significant real estate or those undertaking major renovations or acquisitions, specialized knowledge is invaluable. Firms that specialize in TPR consulting and cost segregation studies, they live and breathe these rules. They can help you analyze your UOPs correctly, guide those tricky expense versus capitalization decisions under RBI, help you identify past opportunities for Section 481A adjustments you might have missed, and assist you in strategically planning current renovations to take full advantage of partial asset dispositions before it's too late.
It really seems like trying to navigate this maze without an experienced guide could easily lead to both missed opportunities for savings and significantly increased risk of costly errors.
It definitely increases the risk of making mistakes that could prove very expensive later on. The source even mentions the development of technology, like AI software designed to scrub depreciation schedules looking for potential non-compliance issues. That really speaks to the scale and complexity of the data involved, especially for larger property portfolios. But even with technology helping identify potential issues, the interpretation of the rules and the application to specific facts still require expert judgment.
This has been an incredibly thorough deep dive into what is clearly a foundational yet really complex area of tax law for basically anyone who owns or manages tangible property in their business.
It truly affects everyone, doesn't it? From the sole proprietor with just a small home office deduction claim all the way up to large multinational corporations with vast real estate portfolios. Getting the TPRs right is just fundamental to sound financial management and tax compliance.
Let's try to quickly recap the journey we took through this TPR guidebook today. We started way back with the problem the TPRs were designed to solve, that old subjective mess of trying to distinguish repairs from improvements.
Right. And how the mandatory TPR, starting in 2014, aimed to introduce a much clearer, more structured framework based on specific definitions and tests.
And we explored those essential starting points. Correctly identifying your specific unit of property, UOP, which sets the scale for analysis, and understanding the 9 specific building systems within a structure, because costs are often analyzed at the system level.
Exactly. Those are the building blocks. Then we looked at the core decision process when safe harbors don't apply using those Roe BI tests. Restoration, adaptation, and betterment, which help you determine if an expenditure is a capital improvement that needs to be capitalized over time.
We also learned about the simplifying safe harbors, designed to reduce the burden for certain costs. The de minimis safe harbor, DMSH, for small dollar items requiring that crucial annual election.
$2,500 or $5,000 threshold.
The small taxpayer safe harbor, STSH, for qualifying small businesses working on smaller buildings. Also an annual election, but with that tricky all or nothing cliff limit.
Lesser of 10K or 2% of basis.
And the routine maintenance safe harbor, RMSH, for predictable recurring upkeep, which conveniently applies automatically if the criteria are met, no election needed. These all offer pathways to immediate expensing.
Great summary of the simplification tools. And then we highlighted those powerful planning opportunities the regulations unlock, like using Section 481A adjustments, often needing that complex Form 3115, to potentially expense costs today that were incorrectly capitalized in prior years under the old thinking, allowing for a valuable catch-up deduction.
Looking back to fix things.
Right. And the immediate tax loss opportunity presented by partial asset dispositions, PADs, when you replace major components during a renovation. But we emphasize heavily that PADs are strictly use it or lose it. You must claim that loss in the year the disposition occurs.
Time sensitive.
Very time sensitive. And we touched on how all these rules interact with the back-end depreciation system, MACRS, including GDS versus ADS, and how powerful tools like Section 179 expensing, bonus depreciation, and of course, cost segregation studies fit into the overall picture, both for accelerating deductions on capitalized costs and for providing crucial documentation for TPR compliance and enabling strategies like PDs.
And finally, maybe most importantly, we underscored the very serious risks of not complying with these mandatory regulations: disallowed deductions, unexpected back taxes, significant interest and penalties, and a much higher likelihood of a painful IRS audit. And we noted that correcting errors after the fact often requires filing that complex Form 3115.
Yeah, the clear message running through all of this is that while, yes, the TPRs are complex, they also provide a defined framework. When you understand it and apply it correctly, it's not just about staying out of trouble with the IRS. It's actually about optimizing your tax position. It can lead to significant immediate tax savings through proper expensing, improve your overall cash flow, and help you avoid those potentially devastating penalties down the line. But getting it right really requires careful analysis, good documentation, and often the guidance of experienced professionals.
So Whether you're a property owner, a real estate investor, or just a business owner with significant tangible assets like machinery or equipment, understanding these rules isn't just a compliance chore. It's essential. Reviewing your current practices for handling property costs and maybe even looking back at past expenditures through this TPR lens seems crucial for maximizing your tax position and just ensuring you're playing by the mandatory rules.
Proactive engagement with these rules rather than reactive panic when an issue arises is absolutely key.
Definitely. So let me leave you with this thought. Considering the use it or lose it nature of big opportunities, like claiming a partial asset disposition loss only in the year you complete a renovation, how might proactively planning for all your future property expenditures, thinking about the TPR implications before you even start the work, whether it's routine maintenance, a minor repair, or a major improvement, how might that proactive approach fundamentally change how you manage your tangible property assets and ultimately their impact on your bottom line and your taxes?
That's really the strategic shift, isn't it? It elevates property management beyond just operational necessity or basic financial accounting. It turns it into a proactive tax planning exercise. If you start integrating TPR considerations right into your capital budgeting process, your renovation planning, your maintenance schedules from the very beginning, you could potentially unlock significant tax benefits you might not have even realized existed. You could prevent making costly missteps in how you classify things. It really makes decisions about property maintenance and improvement into potentially significant tax strategy decisions.
Definitely something for every property owner and business manager to think about. Thanks so much for guiding us through the complexities of the tangible property regulations today. This was incredibly insightful.